Good morning. Happy spring. Can you believe this? I thought spring was supposed to be here by now, but doesn't look very good out there today and tomorrow from what we've seen and heard. We will call a meeting to order. This is State Government Finance Committee for March 22, 2011. And members, our plan for today is that we're going to give an overview of the DE amendment to House File 577, which will now be our omnibus state government finance bill. I will make some introductory comments, and we will call upon our fiscal analyst, Ms. Roberts, to go over the numbers, and Mr. Shepherd will walk us through the language section of the bill, and then we will take questions from the committee for as long as it takes to get through that. And once that is completed, we will then open the floor for those who wish to testify on the bill. since we have a session scheduled, four sessions scheduled at noon today, I would hope we probably should try to shoot for maybe 11:30 or thereabouts as the time where we would conclude for today. And so we'll take as much testimony as we can during that time frame, and then we will resume testimony tomorrow morning. And we will begin at 8:15 tomorrow morning and take testimony all morning if we need to. We will have the room until noon tomorrow, as well as having it until then today. And members are reminded that amendments are due by noon tomorrow, so we would ask everyone's cooperation with that request, that we have to have our amendments submitted by noon tomorrow. Then on Thursday morning, again at 8:15, we will start the process of markup. And I hope, as we stated before, that we can mark up the bill, finish marking up the bill by noon on Thursday. If we don't, we may very well have to come back Thursday night. And we don't finish then, we may have to come in Friday morning. So I hope that's not the case. I really hope that we will be able to finish markup by noon on Thursday. So that's the plan. Any questions about the schedule and the plan for how we're going to deal with the bill? If not, let me first of all give you a few overview comments about this bill. We had a very, very big original target for this committee, a target of $443,658,000. That was a very daunting task. Fortunately, that overall target was broken down into a couple of pieces for this committee. First, we were asked in the target to find $81.2 million in reductions or savings in general fund budgets over which we have control. And in addition to that, we were asked to find at least $90 million of additional potential savings that could be achieved through various provisions in our bill. We can report to you today that we've met our targets. And obviously, the rest of the $443 million is going to be met in other budgets, other finance budgets that will be coming forward. This bill, to no one's surprise, has some substantial reductions in some areas of the budget. And suffice it to say, we have proposed more reductions than what the governor has proposed. One example of that, the governor has proposed a 6% reduction in the workforce. This bill proposes a 12% for the next biennium, and moving towards another 3% to 15% by the following biennium. In terms of in this budget, the range of reductions for agencies, the constitutional officers, range from 8% to 12.5% reduction. The major agencies and boards range from 8.2% to 20%. The small agencies, small boards, range from 7.6 to 15%. Now, I want to also point out, well, there's going to be an immediate reaction that we're poles apart with the governor, and obviously we have more reductions than the governor has. But I went through and took a look. There are $256 million of expenditures where we're identical with the governor, that we are proposing the same as the governor. And one of them, the only areas of the budget that are being increased rather than reduced, are military affairs and veterans affairs. And we are matching, as I said, the governor's budget on $256 million of funding. The bill also has, we believe, many important reforms that need to be undertaken by the state. We can't just simply reduce budgets without reforming the way in which we do business. We all know that the current spending patterns in the state of Minnesota are not sustainable long term, and we need major reforms. And this bill presents as many reforms as I recall ever seeing in any omnibus bill. And we have a whole long list, and you'll hear more about these. We have the potential of overall savings to the state with the Downey House File 4 of up to $230 million, with the McNamara Freeze Bill, $64 million, the Stensrud House File 1024, eliminating deputy and assistant commissioners, $11 million. The Stensrud CGIP Dependent Audit Bill, $5.4 million in potential savings. And then there are a number of other bills that we don't yet have the real fiscal notes in hand, that we believe that there will be more savings that will accrue to the state. The Downey Bill at 191, which consolidates IT functions. The Downey 1234, which calls for efficiencies in contracting. The Pepin 174 bill on tax analytics. We know that that is going to save. We know that that is going to increase our revenue from compliance. And then the Pepin Bill 864, which is the federal offset legislation. So, members, in terms of reform here, this bill that's before you has the potential of saving, changing things, reforming, where we can save hundreds of millions of dollars in our state budget. And so that is very significant. Now, I also want to say what this bill doesn't do, because there's been a lot of publicity about various proposals here in Minnesota and elsewhere. This bill does not reduce salaries for our employees. This bill does not increase employee contributions to pensions. This bill does not eliminate collective bargaining. And I think it's important for people to understand that as well. Well, with those introductory comments, we would now like to have our fiscal analyst, Ms. Roberts, go over the numbers, and she has prepared a simpler version. You have access to a much longer version, I printed out 35 pages, and my printer almost died in the process of doing that, but we have a simple, more simple page that she is going to go over with you now. Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, members, as the chair referenced, you do have the more detailed version of the spreadsheet in your packet. It's also posted on both the House Fiscal Analysis Department webpage and the committee webpage. But if it's all right with members, I'm going to use the one-page change item spreadsheet to focus on where the changes are in this bill compared to the base. And just real quickly to look at this, the columns that you're going to want to look at are under the chair's rec, the total fiscal year 12-13, those numbers represent the changes from base spending. The next column is the dollar difference between the chair's recommendations and the governor's recommendations. And then the final column is the percentage difference compared to the base. So there's a couple different comparisons there. I just wanted to make sure that people understood what those are. Real quickly, just to summarize the bill, the amendment to House File 577 includes $866.4 million in authorized general fund spending. That's direct appropriations and open general fund spending. These appropriations are offset by a $94.875 million general appropriation reduction, which we will see in more detail when we walk through the bill. That brings the net general fund expenditures to $771.6 million. The bill also includes new general fund revenues of $169.6 million that are attributed to the tax analytics and the federal offset legislation that the chair discussed. And I should note these revenues are also backed up by additional agency reductions. I'm going to walk quickly through the change item spreadsheet. If members have any questions, please feel free to interrupt me, or if you feel like we need to go to more detail, let me know. Starting with the legislature, you'll see that the overall reduction compared to base is $9.46 million. This represents a 7% reduction overall, 8% for the Senate, 5% for the House, and 10% for the Legislative Coordinating Commission. Moving down to the constitutional officers, the governor, there's a $532,000 reduction compared to base. That's an 8% reduction. For the attorney general, it's a 12% reduction, or $5.5 million. For the secretary of state, a net reduction of $610,000. But I should note this includes the fiscal year 11 appropriation to reimburse the counties for the cost of the recount. Going down to the state auditor, the reduction is $2.3 million for the biennium from base, and that's a 12% reduction. Going down to the state agencies, the first one you'll see is the Campaign Finance Board. That's a 10% reduction against base, or $144,000 for the biennium. For the Investment Board, a 10% reduction, or $28,000 for the biennium. For administrative hearings, a $66,000 reduction. That's again a 10% reduction. And for the Office of Enterprise Technology, a $1.6 million reduction, which is 15% against the base. For Department of Administration, there's a recommended reduction against base of $4.68 million. That's a 13% reduction. For public broadcasting, which these grants are contained in the Department of Administration's total numbers on the detailed sheet, you'll see the reductions of $222,000 to public TV. I believe that's a 10% reduction to those matching grants. And then for Minnesota Public Radio, a 15% reduction to their equipment grants. For the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board, a 10% reduction of $68,000. For Minnesota Management and Budget, the total reduction against base is $4.8 million. That's a 13% reduction. Moving down to the Department of Revenue, you'll see that under the chair's recommendations, there is an operating budget reduction of $39.7 million for the biennium. This is offset by an additional appropriation contained in the bill, totaling $34.8 million, and that is for the tax analytics piece and additional compliance activities. And I should note that that amount is expected, that $34.8 million is linked with an additional $133 million in revenues, which would net to a gain of $98 million for the general fund. Moving on to the Amateur Sports Commission, you'll see a $52,000 reduction. That's 10%. Moving on to the councils, the Black Minnesota Council, the operating reduction is a 15% reduction, or $92,000. Chicano Latino Affairs Council, also 15%, or $86,000. Asian Pacific Minnesotans, 15%, which represents $80,000 against the base, and the Indian Affairs Council is 15%, or $146,000 cut. For Explore Minnesota Tourism, the recommendation is a $1.8 million reduction against base. That's 10%. For the Minnesota Historical Society, the total recommended reduction of 12% represents $5.2 million. This includes $5.1 million to the Society's operating budget reduction, and then an additional $74,000 to the various fiscal agents. The State Arts Board, the reduction is $3.3 million against base. That's 20%. Humanities Commission, a 10% change. That's $50,000. For the Public Facilities Authority, this is the small part of their budget that represents the technical assistance grants is eliminated. You may recall from testimony that this represents a very fractional part of their budget. For the Science Museum of Minnesota, a 15% reduction to their grant. That's a $356,000 reduction. And for the contingent account, a $400,000 reduction against their base of $500,000, so that's a 80% reduction to that account. For the Minnesota State Retirement System, the numbers here represent a one-year suspension of the statutory appropriation for the legislative retirement program. That's the pre-1997 program that we discussed several days or weeks ago in this committee. Again, this is just for the biennium. And then there would be the need to reinstate that appropriation again. Moving down, you'll see under military affairs, here there's actually an increase in spending of $3 million, one-time spending for the tuition reimbursement increase. That's an 8% increase in that program. Under veterans affairs, the net change is $2.79 million. For three change items related to the Fergus Falls Vets Home, the Minneapolis Adult Daycare Program, and then reinstatement of the Higher Education Veterans Officers Program. So that represents the individual changes to the agencies. I should note I'm only focusing on the changes. If you want to see the actual appropriation amounts, they are in the more detailed spreadsheet. Then moving down, I'm sorry, you can't see the line items on the left. I was trying to use a bigger font and I forgot to make the column wider. So, but you'll see about midway down the page the $94.875 million general fund reduction that applies to all agency operating budgets. You'll see the summary of the total expenditure changes within the bill compared to the base. That's $141.3 million, which includes the direct reductions. Also the expenditure increases in the bill, and then the general reduction. And finally, at the bottom of the bill, of the spreadsheet, you'll just see the revenue changes that are included at the very bottom under the Department of Revenue of two pieces, $133 million for the tax analytics and other compliance, and then $36.6 million for the federal offset legislation, totaling $169.6 million. And the general fund reconciliation at the bottom of the spreadsheet shows the general fund base as established in by law was $912.9 million. The net expenditure changes are a reduction of $141.36 million, which brings us to the $771.6 million in general fund spending authorized in this amendment, less the $169.6 in projected new revenues, which results in the net general fund spending of $601.958 million, which is the target that will be amended in Ways and Means on Wednesday. questions.
Questions from members for Ms. Roberts. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, can we have a slower explanation of the Public Facilities Authority and the retirement system? The 100%.
Sure. The Public Facilities Authority provision is just $170,000, and from what we've gathered in conversations and the testimony that he provided, that would not create problems. Now, if there's some new evidence that's come forward that there are problems associated with that, then we need to hear it. But
just some background about why it won't be a problem.
Well, Representative Murphy, we understood from the conversations that we've had with Mr. Coleman that this would not pose a problem. If we get information that it does, then we'll have to adjust that in any future amendment that we might put together. With respect to the legislator's pension, we had a $5.3 million, in fact the governor's budget had a $5.3 million appropriation from the general fund to help cover the obligations under the earlier retirement fund for legislators, some of who are still active that are in that fund. As you well know, Representative Murphy, that fund is headed for a zero balance in reserves within a matter of 4 years. And it's my feeling that that issue needs to be addressed now by the Pension Commission. We need a long-term fix for that. And by eliminating this $5.3 million general fund appropriation, I think we're helping to move along the need for the Pension Commission to solve this problem, which needs to be solved. I mean, we're going to continue to keep our promises to those who are under that system, absolutely have to do that. But we need a long-term fix, and right now the fund is headed for a zero reserve balance here in just a few years. Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Chair, the date, 1997?
Yes.
What? Tell me the significance of that date.
Well, that's when the fund was closed, and so legislators that took office after that date are in a new fund. As I understand, you are one who's in the old fund. I think most of us around the table, most of the rest of us, except for Representative Kahn, are in the new arrangement, which is a different fund, obviously. But that fund was closed. And so that's the problem. When you close a fund, you don't have any more people contributing to it. So as your assets don't grow, as you well know, except whatever investment growth you have, and therefore you reach a point where your unfunded liability exceeds your capacity to meet the obligations. So. That's the thinking here, and I will urge the Pension Commission to address this issue right away, because we need a long-term solution.
Thank you.
Representative Kahn.
Well, two questions, actually, following up on Representative Murphy's questions. Is what was that Technical Assistance Public Facilities Fund used for? And can it be replaced then from the dedicated funds that they have, that they control?
Representative Gunther, can you help with that? I think this is some of the assistance to local communities, I believe, or Ms. Roberts, do you?
Mr. Chair, it represents the small community technical assistance grants. It goes to about 15 to 30 communities, I think.
Obviously, if small wastewater and water grants is the provision there.
But So the question, how does it get replaced then? That sounds like, just from the title of what it says it's doing, it sounds like it's one of the more important things that we might have. If the word small communities, unless you're talking about Edina, makes me believe that they probably can't afford to deal with one of the primary public needs we have, which is wastewater treatment.
Well, Representative Kahn, the $172,000 applied statewide doesn't provide very much money, and as I well know as a former mayor, the costs of water and wastewater projects are enormous, and $172,000 statewide is not very much money. And like I said, if there are problems here that we may need to adjust this going forward, but. Representative Kahn.
Then continuing, historically, going into that legislator's fund, for a while, wasn't it that we had no fund at all there, that it was just appropriated each year as it was needed?
Ms. Roberts, do you have
Is there any reason not to do that, except for, you know, Gatsby principles or something?
Ms. Roberts, can you answer that?
Mr. Chair, I can give you some history. If we want to get more detail, we might have to have Mr. Bergstrom come back to the committee, but prior to 2003, there was an appropriation in the state government finance bill that was for members under that plan. MSRS would estimate their annual retirement benefit as they retired, and we would appropriate that amount each biennium based on MSRS estimates. At the same time, members were paying in a contribution, a percentage of their salary of 9%, but those contributions actually went to the general fund. They never went into a fund. In 2003, that funding stream was changed, so now we only appropriate the amount, the annual amount, not the lifetime amount of the benefit. And so it stretched that funding obligation out from really till the last member retired, till the last member is no longer collecting the benefit. And what the reserve that you're referencing, which I believe is about $28 million, represents those contributions that were made prior to 2003, the lifetime benefit, and we've been spending that down as we've now moved to this new funding arrangement.
What?
Representative Kahn.
A decision to go back to that old, first of all, the annual appropriation would clearly be much less now than it was at the time when we, well, maybe not. Probably the people who've retired have longer life expectancies than the people who are still here.
Yeah.
But the, how much was about that annual appropriation?
Ms. Roberts?
I don't expect you to remember.
Mr. Chair, I don't remember, but I can go back and look at it.
Okay.
Well, Representative Kahn, like I said, this needs to get resolved by the Pension Commission, and I hope that the Pension Commission gets organized here soon. Other questions on the numbers? If not, let's move to the language. Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll be working off of the rule itself, the delete everything amendment that's labeled A110103.
Here it is.
And Ms. Roberts, in covering the spreadsheet, has already covered all of the information that's in the bill on page 1 through 17. This language just implements the spreadsheet decisions that she just went through. So I'll start at the very bottom of page 17, and I'm just going to go through this in index fashion because most of these bills you've already heard and discussed, but if you have questions, please stop me, and I'd be happy to answer detailed questions on them. The first bill that is contained here is on the very bottom of page 17, line 17.28. This is Representative Detmer's House File 384, and it repeals the sunset on the campus veterans representatives on the Minsky campuses, so that program would continue permanently now with this sunset repealed. Article 3, starting on page 18, the section 1 is Representative Kahn's House File 110, which expands the membership of the Pension Commission from 5 to 7 members from each house. The next 10 pages of the bill, beginning on the bottom of page 18 and continuing through page 27, are Article 2 from Representative Banyan's House File 2. This is a sunset commission and the criteria for it to evaluate state agencies, and at the end, a schedule of expiration for the state agencies. This is on continues through page 27. And that bill is, I believe, either identical or substantially identical to the bill that you heard in committee. On the bottom of page...
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Shepherd, could you give us that bill number again?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, it was House File 2. This is Article 2 of House File 2.
You may proceed.
Mr. Chair, the next section on the bottom of page 27 is Representative Murray's House File 1063, Section 23 of the bill. This is the bill dealing with the issue of the state auditor and counties hiring private firms. Mr. Chair, the next section on the bottom of page 28, Section 24, is one of several sections that I'll point out from Representative Stensrud's House File 1024. This is on Section 24 is actually the key section of the concept. It says that no department or agency may have more than one deputy except for the Department of Veterans Affairs, and that no agency may employ an assistant commissioner. Section 25 on page 29 is one of several sections from Representative Downey's House File 192. This section and several others that I'll point out deal with state contracting process. On the bottom of page 29, continuing over to page 30, section 26 is from House File 299 from Representative Quam. This is the program that allows state agencies to carry money forward from one biennium to a next under specified conditions. On the bottom of page 30, section 27 provides that in order to provide the public with greater access to legislative proceedings, that parking spaces in front of the Capitol would be reserved from the for the public.
New members should know this is a perennial item in our budget, right, Representative Kahn?
Yes. Representative Krenke, Representative Seifert, who else? Who are the list? Representative Haas, it's me, who else? Whoever. Rukavina, yes.
It's a perennial.
But this year there may be a difference.
Yeah.
And one of the pieces of evidence I've alerted, hopefully we're going to have a real blizzard on Wednesday, and I've alerted the House photographer to take many pictures of senators sweeping off their cars in front. And you see the Democratic senators are suddenly under covered parking, and the Republican senators, for the very first time, are out in the open. So this may be the year for it.
Out in the open.
It's delightfully closed.
I don't run.
Yeah. We'll be waiting to hear on that one. Yeah. Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair, on page 31 and continuing on through the next four pages is the zero-based budgeting part of Representative Banyan's House File 2. This is sections 28 to 33 in the bill, and that continues over to page 34. On page 34, section 34 is a section from Representative Quam's House File 292 that connects to the carry-forward authority. Section 35 on that page is from Representative Downey's House File 192. It's an employee gain-sharing system. And Section 36, and continuing on for the next three or four pages, is the Paper Performance Act that authorizes issuance of appropriation bonds that would have performance-based contracts with nonprofits. This is from House File 681 of Representative Downey's. That continues over to the top of page 39. That Section 39 is part of implementing Representative Stensrud's House File 1024 about the number of deputy commissioners. Section 40 and 41 are from Representative Downey's House File 192. These sections both strike language relating to state service contracts that currently require that before entering into a contract, the agency must determine that no current state employee is able and available to perform the services. Section 42 on page 41 is from Representative Pepin's House File 864. This is the authority to enter into reciprocal agreements with the federal government for offset of debts that are owed. And as Ms. Roberts indicated, there's a provision that I'll explain later in the bill that attributes new revenue of approximately $36 million to this provision. Section 43 on page 42 is language that the legislative auditor, Mr. Nobles, discussed with you when he was in last week, and this provides that he may that an outside CPA or private auditor can audit the state fair instead of requiring him to do it every year. Section 44, continuing on to page 43, is from Representative Stensrud's House File 1024, relating to the striking references to assistant commissioners. On page 44, section 45 is Representative Stensrud's House File 756, amending the language governing the performance, appraisal, and pay system for state employees. There was a significant deletion from this bill. The portion of the bill that previously had a 5% bonus provision for the next biennium has been deleted. That is not here any longer. On page 45, section 46 is from Representative Downey's House File 4. This is identical to the language the committee acted on before on the 15% reduction by 2015, except that on page 45, line 5 now requires that a 12% reduction in the upcoming biennium, 12 out of the 15. Moving over to page 47, page 47 and 48 both implement Representative Stensrud's House File 1024. These all strike references to assistant commissioners in various agencies. At the bottom of page 48 is a section that Mr. Nobles, the legislative auditor, brought to your attention last week when he was here. This allows him to carry forward certain money from prior bienniums to be used to do Minsky audits and legacy fund audits. On page 49, section 55 is from House File 127 from Representative McNamara. This is his salary freeze language. There is a change here from the prior version that was heard in committee several weeks ago, and that is that in Chair Lanning's bill, this now applies only during the biennium ending June 30th, 2013. It's not a permanent salary freeze. Section 56 at the bottom of page 49, the original concept that this related to was in Representative Downey's House File 192, which had a study comparing state job classifications to private sector. In Representative Lanning's bill, this is taken in a different direction with this study, which now requires MMB to report to the legislature on a process to redesign and consolidate the state job classification plan with a goal of assigning all classified positions to no more than 50 job families. There would be a report back to the legislature next January. Page 50 is a language that Ms. Roberts and Chair Lanning referenced earlier. This is derived from Representative Pepin's House File 174, a tax analytics study in the Department of Revenue. Material added here is at the bottom of page 50, which provides that incorporating this system of tax analytics, the Commissioner of Revenue must identify and collect tax liabilities from individuals and businesses that currently do not pay all taxes owed. There is an appropriation, as Ms. Roberts indicated in her spreadsheet, of a bit over $34 million for this purpose. And on the last line of page 50, it states that the initiative is expected to result in new revenues of $133 million for the upcoming biennium. At the top of page 51, states that if the commissioner determines that the initiative will result in revenues of less than $133 million, the commissioner would need to reduce general fund appropriations to executive agencies for agency operations to make up the missing increment. The next section, section 58 on page 51, is from House File 864. This is the revenue from federal offset. I mentioned the bill earlier. This is a provision that states the expectation that implementing this new federal offset legislation will result in increased revenues of at least $36.6 million during the upcoming biennium, and a statement that if the commissioner determines that this will not occur, that MMB would reduce general fund appropriations to executive agencies by the missing increment. At the bottom of page 51, section 59 is from Representative Stensrud's House File 1090, the bill that you heard last week on the State Employee Group Insurance Plan Dependent Eligibility Audit. Finally, Mr. Chair, Article 4 of the bill is from the bill that Representative Downey and Representative Kahn sponsored on House File 191, which would consolidate information technology services and employees across executive agencies into the Office of Enterprise Technology. The original bill had an appropriation, a blank appropriation, to deposit money from the general fund into a technology improvement account. That is not here. There is no money appropriated into that account in this bill as it stands now. The account is created, but it is not funded. Mr. Chair, that concludes my overview of the language items.
Representative Kahn.
Would you explain the federal offset program again, somebody?
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, the language on the federal offset program is on page 41, section 42. This is from Representative Pepin's bill. Under this program, the Commissioner of Revenue would be authorized to enter into an agreement with the federal Secretary of the Treasury, under which the United States would submit debts that are owed to federal agencies for offset against state payments, and the state would submit to the federal government money that it would offset from its payments for state debts. And this would, the details would be contained in an agreement that would have to comply with federal law and rules that govern this type of agreements.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, where does the money estimate come from? The process is understandable. How do you get the... Who gave us that number for the money?
Ms. Roberts, you...
Mr. Chair, we have requested a fiscal note from the Department of Revenue, and I believe they're in the process of completing this. Their estimate on that number.
Also, Representative Kahn, this was modeled after a similar program in the state of Maryland. And
I don't know, Mr. Chairman, I don't know an awful lot about interstate finances, but from having been in Maryland, it seems to me that Maryland has an awful lot more of very, very expensive federal programs than we do, and the kinds that we've heard are very susceptible for waste, like, you know, $1,000 toilet seats or something like that. I guess we'll wait for the fiscal. Are we going to pass this bill out before we get the fiscal notes?
Well, we're going to have to move forward with the bill. I mean, we got a deadline, and hopefully we will get the fiscal note information that we need prior to that time, but we need to move forward in passing out the bill. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just need, Mr. Shepard, a little more refreshing on tax analytics and the vendor contracts and the $133 million of revenue. It doesn't click in my memory.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Pepin's original bill had the authority or the mandate to issue a request for a proposal to implement a system of tax analytics and business intelligence tools. This bill adds the requirement at the bottom of page 50 that in incorporating this system, the commissioner is to identify and collect tax liabilities. And then the bill estimates it appropriates money for this, which was not in Representative Pepin's original bill, and estimates the amount of new general fund revenue that is estimated to be collected as a result of that.
This was liabilities that were owed to the state, and it allows this new contractor to go after them.
Representative Murphy, what we're talking about here is using a system that's been used elsewhere to identify more accurately and effectively individuals and businesses that should be audited, and using the kinds of tools that are available now and many states are using to help not only identify but to be able to process those. Revenue needs to be in control of all of our information, and I have met with Revenue about this. And if there is to be a field audit in these cases, Revenue needs to be in control of that. But there are vendors out there who have tools that they've used elsewhere that have shown that they're able to identify taxpayers who are not paying what they ought to be paying. So the whole purpose of this is compliance. And the whole purpose of this section is to improve our compliance, to give Revenue the kinds of tools that they need that they don't have right now. And Revenue has told me directly in a meeting I had with them that they don't have the tools currently available to them to do what many other states are doing. And so what this provision is all about is giving Revenue the tools and the revenue to go out and contract with these companies that can help them do a more effective job in identifying who should be audited and what kinds of tax obligations they have. And so it's a different approach to compliance that has proven successful elsewhere.
Mr. Chair, was this the testimony we had just last week in the evening?
I forget when it was. It's all a blur to me as to what day we heard what
Van
here. But
Dellen?
Yes, we
with Van Dellen. No,
no, that's
that
a different.
Was different.
That's a different one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you,
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have three questions. One on the page 34 of the House File 681, the Downey bill. Is that, and I don't know, Mr. Chair, if I ask you this or to Representative Downey, yesterday you did a referral on the House floor related to bonding. Was that the piece that you referred to bonding?
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Slawick, we laid it over here in state government finance and come to find out there is House rules that specify that any bill referencing bonding needs to be heard through the Capital Investment Committee. So we referred the bill over to Capital Investment. It will be heard this afternoon and will be referred back here. We left the laid over language in the omnibus bill, assuming that all of that will go as we plan, and the bill will then be back in the jurisdiction of this committee appropriately to be included in the omnibus bill. But yes, you're right.
That was my question. Is how that process is going to work? It sounds like you have that one down. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other question I have is, I have two more questions. One is on page, on page 50 and page 51, we're finding a lot of similar language to this in the Health and Human Services bill. As you know, Mr. Chair, you're having new general fund revenues, in this case of the $133 million, and then if they don't come in, you ask the commissioner to make cuts. Is that, has MMB authorized that in our fiscal notes? We've never seen where you can book savings like that, Mr. Chair, so I wondered about that process. We see that in several places. It's also on page 51, the $36 million for the offset program, and then again, if it's not found, the commissioner has to make the cuts. I'm just wondering about your thinking, Mr. Chair. We've never, I don't think we've seen that in bills before.
Well, Representative Slawik, I mean, here's the predicament we're in. I mean, we're talking about reforms, different ways of doing things that have been tried elsewhere, but our own people in doing fiscal notes don't have the prior experience in Minnesota to know what the potential might be. So we've had a lot of difficulty getting fiscal notes on a number of these ideas because they are new approaches, new ways of going at it. And, you know, I'd rather not do this kind of thing, but that's the only choice we have to have the bill be in balance. I mean, if we didn't do this, we could easily be accused of having a bill that's not in balance. Now, I certainly hope that this never happens, that this, in fact, will raise $133 million. We have enough information from elsewhere to suggest that that's a reasonable target, a reasonable expectation. But I sure hope that it materializes. I'd hate to have us have the fallback position come into play here, where the Revenue Commissioner has to, or the MMB has to go in and make additional cuts because we haven't met that target. But it's the box that we're in here with the whole process that we have. So,
now, Mr. Chair, I think it's pretty precarious. You know, we do see a lot of this in Health and Human Services. We see it in this committee. We're booking savings in essence, and we say we're going to save money, and then we're going to have to make cuts potentially after that. I think it's just very risky, and I hope, I don't know how many places it happens overall. If you look at the, you know, it's hard for us because all the Republican House budgets came out in a span of a couple of days. So when we sit on, and as you know, a lot of them are meeting concurrently, so we can't even get to all of our finance meetings at the same time. But to have all these types of savings booked and based on, then the commissioner will have to decide to cut, wondering how it's all going to balance out. So that's just more of an editorial comment. Sure. My last question is about the Stensrud bill that we heard last week on, let's see, is that on page 50? For his, with the, when Van Dellen came in and testified on that one, you don't do the savings, you just say that the contractor has to basically pay for the costs, and then if they can recoup a profit, then they get to keep it. Is that how that works, Mr. Chair? Can you explain that a little further?
Mr. Shepard, would you help on that?
What page is that, Mr. Shepard? Mr. Chair, sorry.
Mr. Chair and members, the language that Representative Slawik is referring to begins on the bottom of page 51 and continues on to page 52. On the bottom of 51, it requires the commissioner to issue a request for a proposal, and then on page 52, it requires the commissioner to enter into a contract, and it requires that to incorporate a performance-based vendor financing option that would compensate the vendor on based on the amount of savings. So there is no appropriation specifically designated for this contract. The contract would be a performance-based vendor financing option.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slawik.
Just to clarify, Mr. Shepard, so performance-based means they go into the contract with $0 being paid to them, and then every dollar they recoup, they get a certain percentage, or how does that work?
Mr. Chair, and
Mr. Shepard,
and Representative Slawik, that would be, of course, left to the details of the contract, but I believe the testimony from Mr. Van Dellen last week indicated that one likely way that this would work would be that it would be based on a percent of savings that the program saved from finding dependents that were not eligible to participate.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Slawik.
So, depending on how many people are found to be, how much fraud there is, and kicking them off health care, they get paid based on that. So, I find this difficult. You know, back, I'm an old, Representative Stensrud, I'm an old fundraiser, and, you know, there were always ethical questions about taking on a fundraising contract and then asking for a certain percentage of it to be paid. Because you, that crosses the line of, what are you going to do to get the money? And sometimes it makes people do things that could cross the line. So I think we need to think about that in this. It's just, again, unusual, something I haven't seen before, Mr. Chair and members. And we're sure basing a lot of the budget on speculation of what might happen here. And I think, of course, we don't know what's going to happen to the economy. We don't know what's going to happen overall. But if we're basing budgets like this, we could find ourselves in a very difficult position a year or two down the road.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I just want to start, make sure I have a kind of a general understanding of the budget target, and I wonder if Ms. Roberts could help me. I want to understand what the cut target is, how much of that is a hard cut to the agencies under our jurisdiction here. I wonder if you could just start with that.
Ms. Roberts.
Mr. Chair, the revised target that was recommended on Wednesday is $601,958,000. Within this amendment, there is included $81.26 million in, I think, what you would consider direct reductions to the agencies within the confines of this release. That's offset by additional spending of $34.8 million for the compliance initiative. In addition to that, so that's a net change of $46.5 million. In addition to those direct changes with the agencies in the bill, there's also the $94.875 million general reduction to all state agency operating budgets. And that, if you look at the language in Section 37, it's attributed to several proposals, including the 15% workforce reduction, the salary freeze, the SIGA dependent audits savings are included in that, reaching that goal. And we do have a fiscal note that we just received on that yesterday. To be clear, the language says that there must be a reduction of $875 million. There are those two pieces that gets you to the net of $771.6 million. Of general fund expenditures, and then there's the additional $169.6 million in estimated revenues, which gets us to the target of $601.9 million.
Okay, and
Representative Winkler
and Ms. Roberts, I just want to make, and then so the cut, the $602 million cut, roughly, and what is the total appropriation the forecasted expenditure, I guess. Existing forecast expenditure.
Ms. Roberts?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler.
Yeah, maybe you better pull your mic down.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, the forecasted expenditures were $912,922,000.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Winkler.
So Ms. Roberts, then the revised target is to cut 600 out of 900 million.
No.
The 601,958 is the net spending.
Okay.
There is a comparing this amendment to the base of 912,922. There are expenditure reductions of net expenditure changes of $141,364,000. And then when you add in the projected new revenues, the difference between the target and the base net of all changes is
$310,964,000. Thank you.
Representative Kahn?
No, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make sure I understood the numbers. So we roughly have a very round numbers, a $310 million reduction. And of that $310 million, we get there by having $170 million in revenue through two revenue initiatives, the tax compliance and analytics and the federal government offset program. So that's $170 million. And then we have $94 million in unspecified reductions. And, you know, Mr. Chair, I guess I don't understand your comment that we're in a tough situation and we therefore have to ignore fiscal notes or go forward to pass a bill by a deadline, even though fiscal notes aren't in, because we have these reform ideas. We've always had reform ideas. We have always wanted to book savings from initiatives for things that we like, even though we don't have any real money. In fact, I think 2 years ago, Representative Simon had a bill for the False Claims Act that we really wanted to book money for to meet our target, but we actually had the fiscal discipline not to make up numbers in order to meet fake budget targets. You know, just to be very clear, this bill is not something that we don't have a choice about. You might not have a choice because of the budget target you were assigned, but the budget target you were assigned is silly and ridiculous and doesn't have any kind of basis in reality for how to fund state government operations. We've got $94 million in reductions that we don't dare to make. We want the governor to do it. We've got $170 million in fake revenue. We have an $82 million reduction, but we're offsetting that by $34 million in new tax compliance. So out of a total target of $310 million reduction, we're actually cutting 46. That's the only real cuts we're doing. It's the only real thing in this bill. And, you know, I know that many people see this as just a political response to Governor Dayton's budget, that this is just something we do. These have to get passed, and they have to get vetoed, and then pretty soon we'll start legislating for real, et cetera. But this is never going to become law. And the biggest concern I have is that you have all these new freshman members of the legislature who haven't been here before. And what they're learning in their first year is that fiscal notes are to be ignored, fiscal notes aren't real, fiscal notes don't have to be included in omnibus budget bills, when in fact they always have been for. And our fiscal discipline, our fiscal responsibility as a legislature is actually one of the things that we have going. We might disagree on revenue, we might disagree on spending, but the discipline of following the fiscal note process and of making sure that bills are real when they're passed is something that we're turning our backs on in this session so far. And I think it's a real damage that your party is doing to this institution, and by turning your back on a long tradition of actually doing things right. Everybody's wanted to do this before, but this is the first time we're actually going forward with fake bills for a fake budget balancing effort.
Well, Representative Winkler, your characterization is wrong. I never said that we should ignore fiscal notes. Never have. We've been working hard to get fiscal notes on all of the proposals that are before us. We've had difficulty getting fiscal notes, and departments working on fiscal notes have had difficulty putting them together because we're plowing some new ground here. And we're anxious to have fiscal notes on all provisions in this bill. We've got a number of them now. We've got hard numbers in those fiscal notes that have told us what the potential is, and we've used those numbers in putting this bill together. And to say that we're going to ignore fiscal notes is just flat out wrong. We're not. We want fiscal notes. We will do everything we can to get fiscal notes. But we need to understand it's difficult because we're proposing things here that Minnesota hasn't done before. And that isn't going to come together in a fiscal note readily like we would hope. And we'll keep plowing away trying to make that happen. Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, first of all, I was going to go in a different direction than Representative Winkler, and I was going to commend you in your ability in negotiating, doing something I was never able to do, and that was in negotiating with your leadership to get your cuts target reduced. I always just accepted it and found a way to do it, so I really commend you on the ability to do that.
Thank you.
But the did you cry or something like that? You don't have to answer that.
Representative Kahn, no, but I've been known to be a bulldog.
Too bad, I'm just a chihuahua. But, but anyway, my question is on the business analytics, because we seem to have contrasting information from the revenue department of the previous administration and this revenue department, although I think most of the people are actually the same. And that is, they specifically told us that they were doing this, they were doing this without an expense, they had some free program from the university that was helping them do that, and I don't understand how the argument suddenly changed. So I'm just interested in that. We always thought that this was that doing that the extended tax compliance, which we always increased each year. They usually argued at first that they couldn't meet it, but then ended up accepting it because it was the only way to balance the budget, and then always met it or always exceeded it, in fact, showed that they must have had something working for them. So how did the argument suddenly change this year?
Well, Representative Kahn, I don't want to speak for revenue, but I will tell you in my conversations with them that they've expressed a willingness and an openness to trying this approach. And obviously, they need to do a further analysis of it and look into the possibilities of vendors who can help them in this process. But they have readily acknowledged that they don't have at their disposal currently, and haven't had historically, the tools at their disposal to do the kinds of things that these more sophisticated audit analyses are showing to be effective in other places, other states. So beyond that, I don't want to speak for them, but I appreciate very much their openness and willingness to pursue this. And we'll wait to hear more from them as we go along. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple comments in response to Representative Slawik and Winkler's questions and summations of the bill. First, with regard to the kind of risk to citizens and the risk to state government through these performance-based contracts, just so people know, this is not new ground for those type of contractual relationships. In fact, go all the way back to the brief recession after 9/11. When state and local governments had a similar downturn in revenues. As a result of that, most contractors with state and federal government really moved hard towards performance-based contracts. And, you know, vendors are great at coming in and representing what they can do, and state and local governments were in a position, kind of forced to be in a position, to hold them accountable. And so this whole notion of performance-based contracts came about. And the reality is the vendor simply assumes kind of the cash flow risk of doing the work, knowing that there is an outcome for the state, and putting themselves in a total 100% performance-based situation before they get paid. So I think the contracting mechanisms are there. State of Minnesota has, I think, used them to some extent, but the ability to protect the state's risk, the vendor's risk, and citizen risk, that we're not, you know, unfairly singling them out, I think is there, and this is nothing new, and I don't think we're submitting ourselves to some huge risk. And just for example, Representative Slawik, you mentioned that we would be going out looking for people committing fraud and kicking them off of health care. My recollection from the CGIP vendors' comments is that all we're doing is identifying people who correctly shouldn't be listed as dependents on insurance policies at the state. And that's not detecting fraud. It's just simply clearing things up. We're not going back and suing them or anything else. But properly, they shouldn't be on as dependents on state insurance policies. And so I don't think that's fairly characterized as fraud. And then, Representative Winkler, just to your point about kind of, I think you called it a fake bill or silly or ridiculous. You know, most of these provisions, I think, have been in bill form or proposed in one fashion or another before. I know many of the provisions that we're putting into this bill were authored by myself and others 2 years ago. And, you know, I think there's a difference today in terms of getting fiscal notes than what Representative Winkler might have experienced for his first terms here. There you had an administration that had been in place for a while, one that had a pretty firm grasp of the tools and the process and the interactions of some of these funding mechanisms, had people who had been in place, and this is no discredit to the Dayton administration, but it's a new team, and they've all just come on board, and they came in and had to get their own budget documents prepared. The reality is those budget proposals had really no reform. So most of the proposals that we're presenting here are new ground, as the chair has said, and then again, isn't to discredit the Dayton administration, but a lot of the things that we're proposing, they haven't thought through, or maybe don't have the mechanics down yet to propose them. And I'll give you an example, a bill that we did not include of mine in the omnibus bill because of the fiscal note was the back office consolidation. And the fiscal note that came back from the department showed zero cost in year one, and then roughly $9 to $10 million in years 2, 3, and 4. So about a $27 million fiscal note, with no savings projected. And so we can't put that in the bill. Now I went back to the Drive to Excellence report and looked at the estimated expenditures at that time for this very same initiative, and I came up with about $13.9 million. In the first 2 years with an offset of 20% savings for the back office administrative functions that we're talking about here. So I didn't make up numbers and somehow lift out the Drive to Excellence numbers and put all the savings in there because I felt like it. We're living within the constraints of that fiscal note and probably passing on a really nice opportunity here that we're going to just have to continue working with the administration to fine-tune. So I think a lot of these comments are maybe just a little overblown rhetoric, and I think we're doing a pretty responsible job given the circumstances, and the numbers that we do have are based on past experience with other states and working as carefully as we can and I think rigorously as we can with an administration that's just getting its feet on the ground.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this is more of a preview for what I hope will be testimony from or comments by the Department of Revenue. But my concern is this. We're booking a 4-to-1 ratio for compliance. That in itself isn't bad because that's, I think, what we did 2 years ago. But the difference this year is that, first of all, on line 61 of the abbreviated spreadsheet here, we're at the same time cutting them by almost $40 million, which is about $35 million more than the governor is cutting them. And they, like every state agency, will be subject to the 13% mandatory cut of workers between now and the end of the next biennium. Now, even assuming that they don't take a pro rata share of that 13%, let's say it's closer to a third of that. Let's say they cut 5% of their personnel. So we're socking them with a $40 million cut, and they've got to get rid of, conservatively speaking, 5% of their workforce. I'm having trouble, just on the surface of it, understanding how we get to the 4-to-1. I have serious concerns about whether the 4-to-1 ratio still stands when they're still subject to those two other cuts. It's more of a statement than a question, and if anyone cares to answer it on the committee, that's fine, but I think that's something that we're going to want to hear from the Department of Revenue, whether those other cuts will impact their ability to get the 4-to-1 ratio. I think that's a fair question. I notice also, Mr. Chair, that, and I hope we'll hear from the Secretary of State's office, that the bill does not include the money for the lawsuit payout. And I'm just concerned that if there's an award of attorney's fees in that case, I'm not sure where that money comes from, whether it comes from their operating budget somehow or where it would come from, since that's not in this bill. So that's another thing that I'm interested in. And then for Ms. Roberts, on the $94 million of savings, and maybe this is on the more expanded spreadsheet, but is that broken down or itemized more? I know, I think I understand about what's in that basket, but is it delineated with any more precision elsewhere?
Ms. Roberts?
Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, no, there's not a further breakdown on the spreadsheet. You will see in the bill language, on beginning on page 13, section 37, that there are several items that are listed to help meet that target of 94,875, or and this combination of things, the reduction in FTE, salary freeze, et cetera, would have savings. We do have estimated savings, I think, for all of the items listed here except for the consolidation of IT systems. We have a fiscal note requested on that. So there are fiscal notes on those provisions. The way to capture those savings, however, has to be through a general fund reduction. For example, just freezing salaries does not create a savings for the bottom line. It creates a savings within agency budgets. To be able to capture that savings and use it to reach the target, there has to be language like this reducing agency operating budgets.
Representative Simon, I could offer a couple of comments in response to your couple of your questions. Obviously, the general fund budget reductions in for revenue and others are going to result in a reduction of employees, and that whatever reduction there is going to have to count towards the 15% reduction overall, the 12% reduction in this coming biennium. We're not talking here about adding another 12% on top of what's going to have to be cut as a result of the general fund budgets that we're referring to here. And so, you know, that's one of the problems with fiscal notes here, members. And you've got an estimate on what the 12% and then 15% would do. We've got a fiscal note on that. But obviously, we also have a budget proposal here that starts working towards that. So how do you factor in, how do you count really what should be in that fiscal note? That kind of gives you an illustration of the difficulty we have here in this budget business. With respect to the lawsuit, as you know, I carried the bill. In fact, it was in 577. I hope at the end of the day we can still find a way to do that. But as we had the challenge of trying to reduce, we had to look at everything. We did still fund in this bill the $322,000 that the Secretary of State had requested to reimburse counties for their costs. And that still is in here, but you know, as we're trying to fit the numbers, we have to look at everything. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, I just wondered if you remember the False Claims Act. I believe you were on the committee when that was part of our omnibus bill. I can't remember if you offered an amendment to take it out or not. But the False Claims Act is a federal program that started during the Civil War, so it has a long track record. A lot of states have their own state-based False Claims Act, and we passed one 2 years ago. And basically that just creates a way for the state to recover money if contractors or others have submitted false invoices or in some way cheated the state out of money. There's a long track record in a lot of states, and as I said, since the Civil War, the federal government had it. So we had a pretty sound basis for estimating what it might bring into the state of Minnesota. Excuse me. And there was some small cost to the Attorney General's office in doing it. And what we did is actually follow any basic good practice in budgeting, which is that we booked no revenue for it. Zero. We included the language, but we created a new program whose proceeds were unknown. And we were plowing new ground, we were reforming, we were doing all the things that I heard you talk about, but we didn't book any money for it because that was irresponsible. And I would submit to you that far from being responsible, a bill that has $170 million estimated in law, you know, so here's what you're telling them in law they have to estimate the revenue to be, the gains to be. And then if we don't get that, well, then maybe, Commissioner, you just have to go and find those cuts because we don't want to make the cuts ourselves. That is irresponsible, Representative Downey. And there is a solid track record in this legislature of actually waiting until we see the results before we start booking the money. That's fiscal discipline. And fiscal discipline is what you're throwing out the window with bills like this.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to refresh your memory, actually, I think I worked a little bit with Representative Simon on the False Claims Act and was at least a bit in the mix in terms of brokering some of the concerns of the business community with a couple of provisions in there, and actually, as you, I think, remember, voted for the bill out of committee and off the House floor. So I have no problem with the False Claims Act. But we did hear from the Attorney General that while we've added the staff with zero expectation in statute, zero accountability from the legislature, holding the Attorney General accountable for some results, we haven't received any. And so we may have added a couple of attorneys and embarked on some interesting new forays over in the AG's office that hasn't produced anything. And so I think what we're trying to do here by actually providing the tools and driving some of the reforms and some of these ideas and then setting the expectation that there will be results from them, frankly, I think that's way more responsible. We've been launching state programs for decades around here with no measurement of the outcome or no accountability for actually producing results behind it. So I guess I just fundamentally disagree, and I think we've belabored the point. I think we're trying to be as responsible as we can in the respect of the department's fiscal notes and still pushing these new reforms that people haven't ever done around here, and I think the chair has explained it pretty well, and I don't think we need to belabor the point a ton more.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And let me know if I'm diving into the weeds prematurely here. but I wanted to draw our attention to line 96 on the abbreviated budget, which shows a 20% cut to the State Arts Board. That cut isn't parallel with cuts to other elements of our budget, and I just wanted to follow up. Is there a reason for that? I guess I'm particularly concerned. I serve on the Legacy Fund Division, and one of our tasks, and I wish Representative Erdahl were here to back me up, is to make sure that the money that we allocate is supplementing and not supplanting. And so I know that colleagues who are on, for example, the Energy and Environmental Committees are probably asking the same question about money that's being spent in environmental programming. Is there a story behind the 20%, or will we be getting there?
Well, we do have a range. I mean, we've got some that are 100% smaller, but in terms of major boards or commissions, that is the largest percentage. The State Arts Board has a lot of revenue at their disposal, both state general fund as well as legacy dollars, and one of the things that I'm concerned about, and I've assured this with the committee before, is that legacy money is used to fund new programs, as we all know, but there's a limit on what legacy will pay for the cost of implementing that program. And we've got general fund is having to pick up the cost of implementing programs that Legacy has funded. And there's something wrong with that picture. I mean, if Legacy funds something new, it seems to me the total cost of implementing that ought to be picked up by Legacy. And so if you're looking for an explanation here, that's an issue that needs to be addressed, in my view. And I don't know what it's going to take to do it. But we need to address that. I know that's a concern that we need to figure out a way to deal with.
I guess maybe we'll keep going, but I'd like to have that conversation at some point. I know in the Legacy Fund Division we've done a pretty concerted job of making sure that the spending is discreet, so to speak, and that the kind of ongoing funding isn't supporting the administrative cost of administering the legacy fund money. And so I know also kind of the history of the State Arts Board is that it's gotten, I think it was 2 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, but again, it also experienced a 30% cut. So its history is that its funding has been going down, not up, with the advent of the legacy fund.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one last comment on the bill overall, Mr. Chair. You know, I've been around here a long time, 7 terms now. And what I always say to people when these big proposals come out is I say, you know, what we do with the legislature is we do things in increments. We don't do big, broad, sweeping proposals when you look at the past and the history of the legislature because we are such a big organization. This bill, and you've heard the term in Congress a lot, but is like a Christmas tree. I mean, it has every kind of reform in it all at once, Representative Downey, which isn't effective. Zero-based budgeting, federal offset, tax analytics, salary freeze, reclassifying jobs, performance appropriation bonds, performance pay, the SAVI program, early retirement. We can't do it all. And all the bills that we're seeing from the majority are like this. I guess it's so you guys get to go home and say that you introduced bills and you had a vote on them to do reform, but there is just no way that this legislature can pass all of those items and make the state budget work. So I think it isn't realistic, it isn't responsible, and it's phony. And Representative Downey, I think when you govern, you have a responsibility to move the state forward. Adding all of this in, it's just not going to happen. You can't possibly do this and $300 million in Health and Human Services of waivers and all the things that are being proposed. When we governed, we did things in increments. It's always been done in increments. So I wish you would pick one thing or two things, and maybe, as Chair Abler said, they're heading towards May 27th. Maybe this is about putting it all out like a smorgasbord, and eventually we're going to wind up with one or two of these, but it's just unrealistic.
Well, Representative Slawick, in normal times, what you say is what will happen and should happen. This is not a normal time. I mean, we've got a $5 billion problem, and it seems to me that requires us to do more than we would normally do to solve our budget situation, and we need to be looking at all the ideas that have the potential of helping us climb out of this hole that we're in. And the $5 billion problem is not just a short-term problem. We're looking at systemic problems with the state's budget going forward. Our budget spending is unsustainable going out into the future, just is not sustainable. And our state economist makes that very, very clear. When we look ahead, doing a 25-year projection, our revenues are projected to grow at 3.9% a year on average for the next 25 years. Health and Human Services spending, on average, is projected to go up 8.5% a year for 25 years. Well, you know what? That eats up all but a few pennies of the whole budget. And with this kind of situation, we're looking at cuts that go way beyond what we're proposing in this budget because of the systemic problems we've got with our budget, the unsustainability we've got. So I agree, in normal times, that's the way legislatures work. That's the way this legislature has worked. But this is not a normal time. We've got a very difficult problem we're trying to address. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you said it well. Just a couple more points to Representative Slawick. You know, we've literally sat watching this tsunami approaching us. I go all the way back to the late 90s with the Within Our Means report from the State Planning Agency that told us and predicted the year. 2010 was the year it put in its report. I think it was back in 1997 when the report was issued, or sometime in the 90s. 2010, and this was irrespective of economic conditions. It was based on just demography. And so we've known this has been coming for a long time. My observation of the legislature before I got down here and the 2 years that I was here is that we didn't do anything and we put it all off. And so when you do a big project like this, big change initiative, you always try and do a change readiness assessment of the organization to see whether it can actually absorb what you're trying to do in that project. And I wouldn't disagree with you. I think we have a change readiness challenge in the executive branch agencies. But to call this big change, I mean, I don't think this is really big change over a 2-year period in terms of my own experience and things that we've had to do in other places. And, you know, it's probably maybe only 25% of what we need to do, frankly, but these are the initial steps that position us for really capitalizing. We're planting the seeds. And you know what, members? We should have planted those seeds in the executive branch, in these agencies, literally 6-8 years ago, and we didn't. We just kept plowing money into the status quo. And frankly, that's what the governor's budget proposal is, plowing more money into the status quo. And then 2 years from now, we'll be plowing more money into the status quo, and we'll never make the changes. And I think this is the legislature that has to say, no more. We literally cannot sustain pouring money into the status quo. And so these are the structural changes that we need to implement. And if we just give an incremental nick here or there, if we somehow think, gee, we can do a 2% cut or a 3% cut and avoid all the pain, you know what? You don't really change what you're doing. All you do is what you're currently doing today, maybe a little bit faster, a little bit better, a little bit smoother, and you never fundamentally change what you're doing. So absent, I think, some big goals and some big expectations for true structural reform, we're not going to do the job for the people of Minnesota. And this is just the start. This is just positioning us to do the real work in the out years. So I think this is a responsible, it's not bite-sized, certainly. It's a big bite of change and structural reform, but it's just positioning us for the real action here that comes down the road. So I applaud the chairman for building what I think is a responsible proposal and a set of goals that are not going to crush the organization, but really position us for the structural reform that we need.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, following up on several of these points, one, I do agree that the legacy funds should pay their share of the administrative costs, but I think this is an irresponsible, and the legacy committee, with due respects to the members who are here without the chair, you know, likes to do really good things. They're not used to doing really hard things. And I think that the responsible thing to have done would have been to identify the legacy funds going to the various agencies like Arts Board, Historical, and Humanities, and so forth, and charged an appropriate administrative fee to those and put it in this bill. And if that meant that this bill had to go to the legacy division, then so be it. But to just tell them, well, we'll let you off the hook by just taking it from the general fund, I think is irresponsible. As to Representative Downey's comments, I'm trying to remember who was governor over the last 8 years and what responsibility the administration might have had for this, but I'm having difficulty reconciling that with your comments. And then the final point is there are certain things in this budget that just seem either, I don't want to say the word partisan or mean, but they don't help us with our financial situation at all. And that's the cut of over $2 million to the state auditor's office to say, we don't like what you're doing under circumstances under which, as far as I understand, there have been no claims of incompetence or doing it wrong. And so we're just going to cut this away. And that doesn't give us a penny more to the general fund. All that does, because every bit of that money was reimbursed to the governors, to the general fund. And so I don't understand our kind of devastating, or not devastating, but doing an attack on a constitutional office that doesn't even raise any money for us. So that's just, I don't know if anyone wants to answer those, but those are my comments. And also another thing I think that we missed on the that we need to, where our budget interacts the legacy fund, is I really think we need to fund all of the auditing that the legislative auditor does on the legacy fund from the legacy fund. I mean, my experience, I don't want to say it was in the private sector, it was actually in the intersections of various government and private sectors when I worked on grants at the university. The university charged more than the probable overhead, particularly looking at grants that my husband, who was in the math department, had. And, you know, the overhead of supplying chalk and blackboards, they didn't even have computers most of those times, seemed pretty low compared to what they took off the grants. But the concept of saying that expenses, that grants, in a sense, or extra money, will pay its own cost is firmly embedded in government and in accepting, and in government accepting it. You know, most of my grants were from the federal government, and they just assumed that the overhead was part of that grant request. And I think that's what we need to do. You know, that's what we need to do in this bill, too, and not just say, well, the general fund will pick it up. I don't know if there are any answer or any comments. But
well, Representative Kahn, we are not picking on the auditor, as you suggested. The budget cut there is the same as it is for the Attorney General, 12%. And the Secretary of State budget isn't that, but we had to take $2 million out of the base in figuring out. Let me finish, Representative Kahn. We had to take $2 million out of the base on the Secretary of State, or we'd run into trouble with the feds in terms of the whole HAVE issue. And if it were not for that, their percentage would have been different. Now, to say that we're picking on the auditor simply because we want to give counties the ability to do their own audits, I don't think is fair at all either, because there are already a bunch of counties that do that, and we're just saying in this bill that let counties do it. The auditor, the auditing standards have to prevail. The expectations of the auditor need to be upheld. The auditor still has the ability to go in and deal with it. So for people to say that we're somehow picking on the auditor here, I think is totally unfair. And I know we will hear from the auditor again, as we've spent a lot of time listening already, and I'm sure we'll hear more. Representative Simon.
Thank you. On that point, Mr. Chair, could you explain a little bit how savings were booked as to that line item? Is there an assumption in place about what percentage or number of counties will seek to do it privately?
Representative Simon, no. There's no way we could do that.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, the point I was making is that there are no savings since the auditor's office. And this is a complicated process that I was involved in at the beginning. At one point, this committee worked on trying to have all special accounts just gone to the general fund and then funded from the general fund, so that we looked at them and that we had control of them. Actually, the auditors was one of the first ones that we did. The auditor used to have, and maybe this is what we have to go back to, maybe if we have a auditor who's less likely to abuse it, but the auditor had an audit practices account, and it was separate from the general fund, and the auditor just charged for its audits, and the money went back into the account. We changed that when we discovered that auditor Arnie Carlson had used that account to refurbish his office, and we didn't think that that was appropriate. I mean, if his office needed specific things, I think it was the first office that actually had a shower and lockers in it, which is something I approve of government doing. But we thought that's okay, but it ought to be funded from the general fund. It ought to not be from this audit practice account. And so that's when we went into this practice of doing it. So someone with better math skills than I can say how long the Carlson administration was. But the point is, we don't book any savings from this. These were charged. True, we're giving counties freedom, but if the auditor is going to have to spend more in overseeing that, I don't know where we're getting those costs from. And if one wants to say that we should change the constitutional duties of the state auditor, maybe we ought to do that with a constitutional amendment. Maybe we just ought to do some kind of a study, you know, instead of doing this, and it wouldn't cost any more money, because remember, this $2 million isn't a cut that saves us any money, because it's money that doesn't come back into the state. I don't know how the computation does that as a saving. And the auditor has very little general fund in their account, so you couldn't do a $2 million cut to the auditor from their general account. But maybe, you know, looking at something, looking at whether there are complaints, there are more counties that want to do it privately. What's been the satisfaction level with the counties that are doing it privately? Is there some trend? Is it small ones or big ones or whatever? Would make more sense than this cut that just says we're assuming that private is better for counties. We're assuming that that counties want it. And we had kind of lukewarm endorsement from the Association of Minnesota Counties, I'll point out, from an administrator who's been on the job for, you know, about 3 months or less than that. And I just think that that's an irresponsible cut to do it without any data.
Well, the issue of giving the counties the option is a policy issue, not a finance issue. Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to the State Auditor's Office. When I spoke to the auditor, the reason that there's only 59 counties are doing it is because that's the only number of auditors they have to be capable of doing it. So to turn it over to the counties and say that you have you can opt out is clearly an attack on the auditor's office to reduce staffing and the constitutional responsibility. And I would point out the county exists because of state government and is at the will of the state government, and the county should have to justify their budgets to the state government. That's just basic constitutional practice, and this is subverting that. And what I would agree with Representative Downing is, you sure are setting the stage. I'm not quite sure that I'm going to be with you with the stage, because this seems like an all-out assault on the auditor's office, and then we move on to public employees. And we can do that, and you're the majority, so your bill will probably pass. And you're setting the stage for a fight, and that's okay, because you're rallying our base, and I'm okay with that, as you attack employees and the auditor's office. But we have some constitutional responsibility with this state auditor, and we need to be protecting that instead of opting out. I don't think counties should report to private auditors. And how do we pay if we have no line item to review these private audits? Because the auditor can't recoup that. So to say that you're not being mean or not attacking the auditor simply isn't true.
Well, Representative Gauthier, cities across the state are hiring private auditors to do their audits. And we have a number of counties that are already doing that. And all we're saying in this bill is to give additional counties the opportunity to do that if they so choose. They're elected people, too, just as the state auditor is elected. They're elected by the folks who are closest to what the decisions that they have to make. And we can't discount that. Seeing no further questions, I think we're ready to start moving towards the testimony phase. we have some people who have requested to be heard, and tomorrow we will spend the whole time hearing testimony. And we have about 9 or 10 folks that have indicated wishing to testify at this point. The first testifier is Niall Zickmund. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, person we've just been talking about, the state auditor. State Auditor Otto. Welcome, Auditor Otto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members and Minnesota taxpayers. I want to clarify one thing today for everyone that said that I was being attacked. I'll be very clear. It's the taxpayers that I'm here for. So they are the ones that will lose out. And it's my job to come and tell you today what we will not be able to do anymore based on the staff that I will have to cut. When I presented my budget, I told you that 90% of my budget covers people. And it's the people that work on behalf of the taxpayers, that's our client, to oversee statewide taxpayer money. They also oversee nationwide taxpayer money. It's not just local dollars. That's why the state has an interest in overseeing taxpayers' money that's collected statewide. You proposed a 12% cut, which means people, and they will no longer be doing the taxpayers' work. So I want to tell you what they're going to lose. So we oversee $20 billion a year in taxpayer dollars spent by our local governments. In an economic downturn, is it showing up? The technology guru is at work. Oh, he got it. Okay, thank you. In an economic downturn, there's a greater need for oversight, not less. We have much more activity of people calling in. Yesterday I had two calls. Some of them are your constituents. And they're really concerned. They want more from my office, not less. We need to keep the staff we have to continue the critical work that the public expects and demands. So the 12% cut will mean we will no longer conduct special investigations into allegations of theft of local government funds to the tune of $20 billion. There will be no more financial data on local government finances. That $20 billion, there will not be any data because I will not have staff to collect it and make sure that it's correct and fix it if it's not. Put together reports that analyze it. That's done. No more responding to public inquiries. We get thousands of people calling every year. And we will not be able to respond to their concerns because my people will be gone. No more reports on municipal liquor stores. Government sells alcohol. People really like this report. The media calls probably on a monthly basis saying, when's it coming out? Because some people don't like the policy. This is done. Our local governments spend taxpayer money lobbying government. This report will no longer be issued, so taxpayers won't know what their governments are spending on lobbying. There will be no more financial reports on criminal forfeitures. You pass laws. The only way staff in your committees know what's going on in terms of property we're taking from Minnesotans and what we're doing with those funds, you will not be able to track anymore. So this helps you determine if your policies are working or not. And after the Metro Gang strike force, I would think that many people, they are interested in this report, but it's gone. Public pension plans, local public pension plans, great interest in these. These are gone. You know, that graph behind me, city finances, we issued this 2009 report for the fifth calendar year 2009 on what cities around the state spent. We have over 800 cities. And taxpayers have great interest in what's happening to their property taxes, to taxes in general, and really appreciate the reports our office put out. But we're not going to be doing the city reports, the county reports, the town reports, the special district reports. Legislators, you're not going to have data on local government anymore because we're the only folks that do this work. And there was a legislature many years ago that tried to cut out this division. And you won't have information anymore. So it's not really about attacking me. Who you're going after is the taxpayers. We will not be issuing best practice reviews anymore to save taxpayer money at the local level. There's thousands of units of local government that we help to save money in every year. These are gone. There will not be central databases of local government financial information. The only place it's housed is in the Office of the State Auditor. And I think that will be a true disservice to not only the public, to lawmakers, researchers, anyone that needs that data. It's gone. And I'm going to conclude with, and I'll finish my thought on this last slide, for the Minnesota taxpayers that are tuned in today and to the lawmakers who were elected by them. between this budget cut and between the county policy language that doesn't have an impact on the general fund, as we know, but you said it wasn't a financial issue, it was a policy issue. This will not allow the Office of State Auditor to oversee over $20 billion in taxpayer dollars anymore. Now, I was told I had 2 minutes, and I think my 2 minutes are up. And if you'd like to grant me more time, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer questions.
Auditor Otto, you say you're no longer going to be able to provide oversight over $20 billion. What are you going to be able to provide oversight over? Isn't the $20 billion the total amount?
$20 billion is what we can oversee, yes. So between the county language that actually does not allow us to have any oversight over counties anymore unless they opt to stay with us, because there's actually language in there that cuts us out totally. The portion that I can do that's left, I'm going to keep two attorneys, but my SI people are gone. They have to support the audit division when we do audits to make sure that there's legal compliance, that local governments are following the laws. And I can tell you there's findings, lots of them every year, because some of them they're not. And the government information division that issues reports, they're gone. They also certify cities for local government aid, so cities, you're not going to get your aid anymore. If there's any left, but that's up to the legislature to decide. The pension division, they oversee over 700 fire relief associations to support our volunteer system. And that staff, they get partially funded by fire state aid, so the portion, as long as it doesn't get cut, they will be able to certify fire reliefs for fire state aid and make sure they're getting their audits and that they're reporting their financial information. We will not be issuing investment reports anymore on our local public pension plans, so that's gone because I have to cut that with this large cut. I can't cut myself because I'm a constitutional officer, so my expenses stay there. And Job Z, we already said we'd get rid of. So what I have left at that point will be two people in legal and the audit division. The audit division, you've got a policy bill that takes away our authority, essentially. The language as it's drafted does not allow us to do that work anymore. So what I want to tell you, the impact for our counties is we're going to lose economies of scale in terms of overhead costs, and our overhead costs are incredibly low. So county audits will then cost more for the counties. We're not going to be able to spare them of that because we can't spread our costs for our technology and our rent and heating and all of that across. We spread it across less divisions, and so therefore it's going to cost counties more to get their audits conducted. And I'm not sure, Mr. Chair, if that's an attractive option for them at this point. So essentially, if my auditors are done, then I'm left.
But Auditor Otto, you are certainly trying to paint a very dire picture, but the reality is that you still have $16 million in the budget. And so I think that you have to be careful to paint a dire picture when you still have a substantial amount of revenue to operate your department. Representative Benson.
I think you asked all the questions. My question was simply going to be, with 12% cut, you still have 88% left. And I'd be interested in knowing how much work you can get done with that 88%. You've told us what you won't be able to get done, but with 88%, it still seems like the lion's share of what the state auditor is tasked to do will still get done.
Auditor Otto?
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, that's a really good question. Thank you. So the pie chart that I have up for you, which I presented when I presented my budget, if you look at the majority of our audit of our shop, what we do of our office, almost 70% of everything we do is the audits of the counties. And all the other little slices, legal SI, government information, pension, they're all tiny divisions with almost no people in them. There's less, you know, on you can count them on one hand. And so when you cut that much, those divisions basically go away. And so what I have left is the audit practice. Now, the policy language that you have in the bill will allow counties to go and leave, and the statewide taxpayer interest of making sure that their dollars that were collected are overseen by an office that has no profit margin and doesn't have to please a county board But we don't have to please them. We're there for the taxpayers. You know, if you think about it, I don't know how many of you have been audited by the IRS, but audits aren't a whole lot of fun. And usually your palms sweat and you feel kind of sick to your stomach. If you had a choice to have a private CPA firm come in and audit your personal finances or your business finances versus the IRS, I bet I can predict 99% of the time what you would say. Because people are kind of scared of the IRS. Well, because they have one thing in mind, the taxpayers. When we do our work, we have one thing in mind, not profit motive, not winning the contract again. It's the taxpayers' best interest. And so there's definitely a difference, but that's where, so all that money you give us, most of it we actually put back in the general fund. 76.3% goes back. And TIF is a separate pot that doesn't have an impact on the general fund. So you can see that little violet purple slice left. That's what I'm having to cut from. That's the other divisions. And I don't want to sound, you know, it's not personal. You're not attacking me. But it's important for taxpayers to know what it means to them. And I understand that you have a very difficult job. I was in the legislature once. I was a lawmaker, and we had a deficit. And it's difficult. But I can tell you that there is nothing left. I was answering the phones at the front desk yesterday.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just a comment. I'm not sure that the comparison of an IRS audit is comparable to a financial statement audit. An IRS audit typically occurs when the federal government detects something out of sync with your tax return, and so that those are typically investigative audits. This is simply, I think, I know you probably do some investigative stuff too on a one-off basis, but the vast majority of audit work is simply certifying the accuracy of the local government's financial statements. So it's not a punitive investigative thing at all. It's just a routine process that audit firms and you go through. But my question is, so I think when this when there were some budget cuts before, back in the early 2000s, and this is a vague recollection, but my recollection is that part of the response was to allow counties that were interested in going to a private audit firm to do that. And so a number have been doing that since then, and we haven't allowed anybody else to do that. So why would your first response be to take out these small, little, potentially really high-value functions, and why wouldn't you just release a larger set of counties to do their own audits?
Auditor Otto?
Mr. Chair, because there's no gain to the general fund for the state doesn't get anything out of it. So if you simply, if I were to cut more counties out, it doesn't do anything. And it creates a revenue hole for the state because not only do you make an appropriation, you also get revenues back. That goes away. You dig a slightly deeper hole for yourself. I know it doesn't make sense intuitively. As Representative Kahn said, it's a little bit confusing how we're funded. But at the end of the day, the county issue was a policy issue, and when there were cuts in 2003, Representative Downey, the current auditor said it was okay. And so some counties had to go private. They had no choice. Some liked the experience and some didn't. Now, you made a statement that no other counties have gone private since, and that's actually not accurate, so I wanted to help clarify that with you. And since I've been in office, two additional counties have gone private. But at the end of the day, what our office does is we're there for the taxpayers' best interest, and it's based on professional judgment with the taxpayer always in mind. And so that should continue. I mean, the system's not broken, so I'm not sure what we're fixing. And, Mr. Chair, I don't mean to distress anybody today, but it is my job to tell the public what's going to happen. And because they have a great interest in this area, even Governor Pawlenty understood the importance of the office and how our funding worked. He didn't go after my office, and he said, what can you do? He knew how incredibly bare we were. We just don't have people to do some of the regular stuff, which actually can build in inefficiencies, support staff and things like that. So he understood that, and his staff and his commissioners came into my office and said, you have nothing. So, I mean, I'm willing to play along, and we've given money back almost every year when the governor's asked, when Pawlenty asked. We were able to find areas. of efficiency, and we keep working on that. But at the end of the day, it looks really severe, Mr. Chair. I wish there was more that I could do. I really do. If I can think of anything, I'll let you know. But right now, we are absolute bare bones. And there's great value in this information. And unfortunately, there's greater demand for this information, not less. Special investigations, when they go away, local governments aren't going to have a place to report that anymore. Sometimes they don't want to do an investigation because it's going to look bad. They're required by law to report to us. We decide what's best. And so investigations get done because we make sure they're done, whether it's us or a private firm. But if the private firms take over all the investigations, I can tell you now, and it's frustrating to taxpayers, they usually get those reports classified as non-public, and nobody gets to see them. And you're just losing transparency. So I really, again, I understand your struggles and your frustrations, and I'm sorry that it's so difficult, but you all ran for that, and here you are. But this is going to have a significant impact in the function of government, and that when we take people's money, that we're accountable to that money, and that they feel secure that we are accounting for that money for them. So the media is not going to have access anymore either, which some of them are upset about, because this is freedom of the press and how they report to their readers on what their government is doing. So again, it's serious, but I know that you have other people who would like to come testify. So if there are no further questions, I want to thank you for your time.
Well, thank you, Auditor Otto. And the next person who wishes to testify is Ms. Herr. Apparently not here. Lucinda Winter. Carolyn Parnell, Commissioner. Okay. Chris Busey. Tomorrow? Okay. And Representative from MAPE? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Richard Kajewski, the Legislative Affairs Director with the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. And I will, as well, try to keep my testimony within the 2 minutes, Mr. Chair. I think I've spoke on many of the provisions already in the bill that we don't care for. Starting with Article 1, Section 37, this bill will result in layoffs and a salary freeze. No vetting of such cuts as Representative Winkler talked about is a little problematic for us. We think that the public, and as well as any of the organizations who represent these employees, should have the opportunity to actually talk about these impacts. We saw MMB put out a report what, for example, the 15% cuts will look like from different agency standpoints, and that's pretty strong testimony in and of itself, and we think that that deserves a proper vetting. Article 3, Section 40 on page 39, that removes state employees. In several places in this bill, I'll just mention it all now, it removes the contracting provision that requires agencies not to contract out when they have state employees available to do the work. Mr. Chair, we don't think that that makes good sense. We don't think that makes good sense from a budgeting standpoint when there's state employees sitting there that are available to do that work and do that type of work on a day-to-day basis, and yet we're removing that piece from statute for the sole purpose of outsourcing government work. We don't think that's efficient. We don't support it. It also conflicts with the IT consolidation language, which I'll touch on shortly. Article 3, Section 45, Mr. Chair, we appreciate the cleanup that this bill that's been done on this provision, but employee evaluations are a critical element to the employees in the state of Minnesota. I will state that we already have a language in our collective bargaining agreement that puts the step increases in the lanes and ties them directly to an employee's performance. And I believe I could probably speak on behalf of most labor organizations in the state of Minnesota to say that that exists today. We've collectively bargained for that language. This actually supersedes that. It places an uncontrollable burden for the employee in the sense that an overall agency has to meet its goals before they can get an increase in pay. The other provisions, Mr. Chair, we believe are already covered in our contract. We believe this goes too far in controlling the contract and saying, you know, a state agency, they may be one person in a large division. For instance, revenue collections. If revenue doesn't collect their targeted amount of money, they might not get their step increase, according to this legislation. The other problem we have, Mr. Chair, to be really frank with you, and not to out state agencies, but there isn't a state agency that I'm aware, except for maybe a small board, that can honestly probably show up here today and look you in the face and say that they're in compliance with all of their employees' evaluations. They're not. They're not getting done on time, Mr. Chair, and the only ones who suffer from that are state employees. We've bargained language that deals specifically with that. It's not in the statute. Article 3, Section 46 is another piece. We don't support this provision, Mr. Chair. Let me just turn the page here.
What's the page?
This is the 15% cut, Mr. Chair. When you take a look at the federal money, as I've already testified once, and remove the positions that are getting partial or full compensation from federal funds, you're removing one in every six state employees that exist in state government today. And I don't know how the work gets done for the citizens of Minnesota. To suggest that state government is fat and can cut 15% just based on measures that we hear routinely now, such as reform, you can't. This work will not get done, Mr. Chair. There just simply is not one in six positions of fat sitting out in state government, and I do not believe that. Article 3, Section 55 is the salary freeze, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to say, I think this is a bit disingenuous. This infringes on our collective bargaining rights, and I know, Mr. Chair, you made a point at the beginning of the hearing to say that this does not take away collective bargaining. I would agree, Mr. Chair, this isn't a right-to-work bill. That provision doesn't exist in this bill, but there's several provisions in this bill that actually remove our right to collectively bargain for wages and benefits, and this is one of them. The last 4 out of 8 years, we've taken wage freezes, Mr. Chair. This removes the democratic process to do what I can speak on behalf of MAPE and many other unions in state government have done, and that's every time we've been asked to pitch in because the state doesn't have the funding, we've done so. We pitched in on the reform for the pension bills last session, Mr. Chair, and we've taken these wage freezes continuously. So I just repeat to you one last time, Mr. Chair, labor in this state and the employees in state government, the 10th leanest government in the nation, have stepped up to the plate every single time we've been asked to step up to the plate through the collective bargaining process. And I ask everyone in this committee to respect that process. The provision below that one, Mr. Chair, Article 3, Section 56, is new. That's the one Mr. Shepard talked about it briefly. That's the state job classification consolidation. Mr. Chair, we can disagree on the chamber study versus the EPI study all we want. The bottom line is, what is fact is that state government employees are much more highly educated than the private sector. The demand for the degreed positions in state government. I don't represent a single person without a bachelor's degree in state government today, Mr. Chair. And to suggest that those specific skill sets that each and every one of you look for in a state employee can just be grouped in to 50 job classes, I think is irresponsible. These people are hay-rated based on their skill set, based on the job that they perform, the oversight, and comparable jobs in the private sector. And to lump them in my opinion, is nothing more than a race to the bottom. And last but not least, Mr. Chair, Article 4, Section 2 and Section 5, if you will. I believe that's the Downey provision. There's provisions in this bill, Mr. Chair, that remove the protection on the outsourcing for state employees. And what this does now is put all the employees, it still puts them under the umbrella of the Office of Enterprise Technology. And let me go on the record, Mr. Chair. I am not opposed to consolidation and reform in that manner. I think we should look at consolidation and reform. And I've met with the state CIO. But to put them all under one umbrella and then allow a commissioner or one CIO to determine outsourcing based on the term value, and I would suggest, Mr. Chair, that you and I might not even agree on what the word value means in this context. But to allow them to outsource while removing the provision previous in this bill, back in Article 3, Section 40, there's no protections. None at all. The commissioner of DHS can go ahead and outsource all their IT just because they find value in doing so, because they no longer would have IT people working for their department, and the statute would allow them to do that. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'm sure I've used up my 2 minutes, and I appreciate your patience. I will stand for questions or
no. Well, thank you, Mr. Kajewski. Appreciate your being here. Mr. Stanton.
Mr.
Welcome, Mr. Stanton. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Russ Stanton, Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization, which is the faculty unions for the seven state universities. I'm speaking in opposition to the pay freeze that's in the bill. The reason we oppose this, of course, is because it's a unilateral method of imposing salary that does not involve negotiations, that does not involve even consultation with the employees, and it kind of makes a mockery of our collective bargaining process that has worked for four decades in this state through very rough times. And it's a very blunt and crude method of dealing with the budget crisis that's based on an assumption that public employees will not be responsible during hard economic times. I would just remind you that 2 years ago, when the economy went south and revenues plummeted, our union came forth. It wasn't the employer that came forth. We came forth and we said, let's just suspend negotiations for the next 2 years. We'll take a pay freeze, zero and zero. I would remind you that the public employee unions who collectively negotiate the state health plan came up with cost containment programs that held those costs at zero and zero the last 2 years, completely contrary to national trends in health care. And as a result of that, our total compensation costs from last biennium to this biennium increased 0.2%, and if you take in, and that spreadsheet that was done by Subcommittee on Employee Relations was done before the zero and zero in health care. Actually, our compensation costs went down biennium compared to the last biennium. We didn't do that in terms of taking a zero and zero because we wanted to simply make an offering to the state. We did it because we didn't want to be negotiating pay increases for some employees, which would cause the layoff of other members of our union. We were trying to protect our young. We know there's no money the next biennium, and we're not going to be negotiating pay increases that would cause the layoff of our younger employees. But what a pay freeze does, when you unilaterally impose it and don't allow negotiations, it prevents us from dealing with things like equity pay, things like market adjustments, things like incentive pay. It would even prohibit us from doing early separation incentives like we have done the last couple of years, which were very, very helpful in reorganizing our colleges and universities, and save millions and millions of dollars by doing that. I would point out that MNSCQ does have a separate board. The members of that board were all appointed by Governor Pawlenty. They include the executive director of the Taxpayers League. They include the former executive director of the Business Partnership. They include the executive director of the Chamber of Commerce. These aren't pushovers that are just going to give away the store. But what this does is prevent us from working collaboratively. We're currently involved in what's called interest-based bargaining with MNSCQ. And in interest-based bargaining, what you do is the two sides set aside their adversarial relationship and try to look for areas where they can collaborate and solve common problems. This would make that actually kind of pointless. Previous legislation, Representative Stensrud's legislation, Representative Downey's legislation that came through this committee, exempted MNSCQ from those provisions. I guess you find the language on 44.29 that I'm referring to. I guess we would, although we're opposed to pay freezes in general, at least request that you consider an exemption such as that and allow us to bargain creatively with our employer. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stanton. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Stanton.
Long ago.
but correct.
You don't keep your title.
but you're always entitled to be called the Honorable. That's one of the perks we have. Mr. Stanton, historically, have there been freezes before? And if so, for how long?
Mr. Stanton?
As long as you mentioned that, I came to the legislature in 1972, shortly thereafter that we adopted PELRA. I can't remember in the last four decades them ever circumventing it with a pay freeze. Even in 2003, when we had a $191 million cut to MNSCQ's budget in 2003, we got through that without doing a salary freeze. We can get by without a salary freeze. In fact, you can probably survive it better without a salary freeze and allow negotiations to work because you allow the unions, and you give the unions a reason to work collaboratively with their employers to try to solve problems rather than just impose it. So that is why we object to it. You know, frankly, I don't think it helps your budget problem at all, the freeze ours. In fact, we're paid out of the higher education budget, so I don't know how a pay freeze here would help in this budget. We would hope that you wouldn't do a pay freeze at all, but if you're going to do a pay freeze, that you certainly let the MNSCQ units, who by the way, MNSCQ bargain separately, they're not part of MMB's bargaining. We would hope that you'd at least create an exemption like you have for in other areas of the bill. Thank you.
Mr. Stan, thank you, and want to recognize the IFO for leading the way in the last go-round by having the most reasonable approach to those negotiations. So we thank IFO for that, and thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here today that wishes to be heard relative to this bill? We will also have testimony tomorrow, but anybody else who wishes to come forward today? Mr. Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Robert Johnson. I'm the lobbyist for Teamsters Local 320, and I'm just going to make my comments very brief because you've heard a lot of testimony in opposition to this bill. And of the 11,000 members that are public employees, often people don't realize that we have a very large local in this state of public employees with Teamsters, and we stand opposed to this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. Tomorrow we have committees simultaneously, and we know there's already 70 people signed up in Health and Human Services. Do we have a large list for tomorrow, Mr. Chair? Or?
At this point, we don't.
Okay.
And if we don't, if we can be done in our normal time, that's fine. We can have the room until noon tomorrow, and if we complete the testimony at 10 o'clock or 10:30, then we can be done.
Mr. Chair, but nobody's signed up right now?
We do have some people that will be here tomorrow.
So there will be.
And several of the names that I read off will be here tomorrow.
Thank you.
Seeing no one else who wishes to be heard today, we will adjourn the meeting.